Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Dionandia podcast. Today, we are going to listen to yet another live lecture that I gave. This one was for the Action Global Health Network conference hosted by the medical students of the University of Ottawa in September of 2014. And the topic that I tackled was the future of global health. And this was based on some work that I did with a former student of mine, Nicole Haywood, where we looked at what the literature was saying about the likely future of global health research and activities in the coming decades. So, without further ado, here was the presentation. So the reason I'm wearing these headphones is that I'm recording this. I try to record as many public lectures as I can, and it'll be on my website streaming. So if this at all interests you, as it might not, you can revisit it later on at my website, which is there, dionandia.com. So today we are talking about this thing called the future of global health. And usually at this conference, in the past, I've talked about career development for people interested, even cursorily, in the global health domain. And this time, we've kind of modified that a little bit to say, given that we project the field to change in these ways, maybe you can dictate your career in other ways that kind of relate to it. Maybe. We'll see. I don't know. When we talk about the future, there are many things we can talk about. We can talk about the future of financing, the future of a disease, the future of demand versus need, the future as it should be versus the future as it will be or might be or could be. We can go all over the place. But today, we're going to look superficially about what the experts are saying as being the growth areas in this thing that I put in quotation marks, global health and development, because those are the words that I use to find what the experts are saying. All right, and the timeline we're looking at is anywhere from 10 to 20 to 50 years, depending upon who's responding. And again, the nuance here is that we're looking at what will probably happen according to the experts, not what should happen. And we're going to spend a little time trying to align those predictions with possible career opportunities, because that's what people your age group care about. like I said, we're going to go very superficially, and please stop me at any time. We can go in more depth than any given thing. And this is not an exhaustive list of stuff. It's merely the stuff that's popping up in the discussion forums right now that maybe will be of interest to you intellectually or career-wise. And I recognize a lot of you in the audience, some of you not. How many of you are medical students? How many of you are other kinds of students? How many of you are former students of mine? That's two. I see more. You're identifying yourselves. Okay, interesting. And I recognize Ziad Khan, by the way, who is not a student. This guy is a global health expert. He shouldn't be in the audience. He should be up here talking. So I just want to give a shout. All right. Oh, embarrassing. All right, so a taste of the findings that we have. And by the way, I can talk forever. So stop me and put me on a tangent. That's fine. The slides are irrelevant. We can go off on a tangent. They'll be on my website. It doesn't matter. Right? So a taste of what we found is that the future is tied to economics. Dunna, big surprise, right? So the changes in world economics about interrelationships, about the globalization and so forth, and the environment, which really is the big wild card here, is the changes being made as a result and part of globalization are affecting the environment in unpredictable ways, and that's going to affect everything. In fact, I believe it's going to be the thing that dominates your agenda for the rest of your adult lives. The rest of your adult lives, as if there'll be a portion of the rest of your lives that are not adult. I don't know. All right. So one thing I want you to think about is, what's a SWOT? What's WSOT? Who knows what that is? SWOT analysis. I've heard that term before.
Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities.
Exactly. So strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. It's a kind of social and management analysis. So even though we're going to present to you some of the things the experts are saying are coming down the pipeline, they're not all going to be threats. They might be opportunities. So we'll try to put a positive spin where possible. Okay. So the sources, there's a bunch of articles in the Harvard Business Review, Partners in Health, which is a well-known global health organization, Harvard we've heard of, Columbia we've heard of. There's a group called Facing the Future. And my former student Nicole is in the audience. She and I put together a review of the literature that attempts to summarize some of the stuff. So I'll be drawing upon some of that literature as well. So the first thing that all the experts are talking about are the emerging economies. What are the BRIC nations? Who's heard that before? BRIC nations are which? Brazil, Russia, India, China. Why did I call the Crib Nations? I have no idea. Right? Makes a lot more sense. Sometimes people throw in South Africa in there. Cribs, BRICS, I don't know. But the idea about the BRIC nations that are so fascinating is they are formerly low-income nations that are now economic super engines that are predicted to be the most economically vital nations by the end of the century. So a lot of wealth, power, organizational acumen, political expression is being moved to those nations. At the same time, they still have profound health needs. So China is a fascinating case because China resembles us in many ways. Demographically, they're old like we are. We're actually an old population. We have more old people than young people. And as a result, their needs, their health needs are migrating from those of a low-income country to a middle-income country to a high-income country pretty fast. And for a billion people to be making that transition, that sort of changes the focus of our species in a profound way, that maybe their health needs will be dictating what the normative health needs are going to be. So we have to consider something called the epidemiologic transition when we're talking about the changes of these nations. Who knows what the epidemiologic transition is? Who's heard that term? Well, Ziad has been not putting his hand up. So there's a guy named Omran who first proposed this, and it's a derivation of the demographic transition. The demographic transition talks about the evolution of societies from being hunter-gatherer to modern and how the birth rates and death rates kind of fluctuate. But the epidemiologic transition is a summary of that has to do with the phases of disease. And there are three phases. The first age is the age of pestilence. And the second age is the age of diminishing pestilence. And the third age is the age of man-made diseases or degenerative diseases. And we believe that most modern nations are in the third age, the age of degenerative diseases. And so these nations are possibly entering the age of degenerative diseases. So what are degenerative diseases? Cancers, diabetes, those kinds of things. And that will be dictating our path. So the next thing that comes up a lot is personalized medicine. Now, that sounds pretty high tech, right? It sounds like something that only wealthy countries will care about. And it might be the case. But there's a nuance here that you might want to consider. If personalized medicine, which flows from the proteomic revolution, becomes a reality for wealthy nations, then how does that drive the overall drug discovery and pharmacological industry? So who knows what the proteomic revolution is? Ever heard of this? Or personalized medicine. Anybody know, ever heard of this? Yes.
The drive towards catering healthcare to an individual patient by looking at their genetics.
Exactly. So I have to repeat what you said for the recording because it's not recording your voice because you're not that special. So the gentleman in the audience said it's the drive towards dictating the individual's medical needs based upon their genome, and that's true. So when the Human Genome Project was completed, the expectation was this would lead to a proteomics revolution where the entire biotech industry would be transformed to service the needs of individuals whose needs could be assessed via their genetics. It didn't happen. It didn't happen because of the fact that the genome really didn't express as much of the human animal as we thought it would. But it still might happen. And a lot of people are throwing money at that idea. So what I want to suggest to you is that if it does happen and the biotech industry moves in that direction, then the needs of traditional health indicators to service those indicators may diminish. And maybe that'll affect the low-income individuals. So just throw that out there. Okay, next factor. Aging populations. You hear about this all the time. When I say aging populations, I don't mean that everyone is living longer necessarily. I mean that we have more old people. There's a nuance there that the layperson sometimes forgets. We're actually not living that much longer. You know, if you're wealthy people or people who live past a certain age and get past childhood diseases have been living into their 60s, 70s, and a little bit in the 80s for hundreds of years. What's happening is we have more people in that higher level now. So the Western world have a lot more old people. Part of the problem with having more old people is that there's fewer young people to pay the bills. So, in fact, this university may have a crisis soon where we have fewer and fewer young people able to pay tuition into these classes. And so we're recruiting all over the world now to fill up those ranks. It's creating a crisis in a lot of industries. So the youngest country in the world of note economically is India. the majority of people in India are under the age of 40. The majority of people in Canada are over the age of 35. 40 or so. And then China's a lot like us as well. And so a lot of these countries that are currently the economic engines of the world are heading towards this demographic precipice. So what does it mean? What does it mean for the transition? What does it mean for rising costs as it pertains to the cost of care of the elderly? So again, in countries like China and a lot of South Asia, which is also transitioning, we're seeing a lot more need amongst the elderly. Now, that's confounded by the rise of the middle class, because suddenly a middle class that wasn't there before, but the people were there before, their needs are being expressed. So breast cancer, the rates of breast cancer are extremely high in South Asia and other parts of Asia. It probably always was high, but now we're detecting it because the money is there to detect it. And that's changing where we intend to invest our skills. Infectious pandemics. All right. Ebola is all over the news. I've been talking about Ebola all the time. It's so funny because I keep getting these calls from media types ask me, should we worry about Ebola? No, you shouldn't be worried about Ebola. Go back, you know. Don't bother me. But, you know, it's exciting, right? But there are other kinds of things that may come down the pipeline. So yeah, influenza is always a concern. And the thing about infectious pandemics that are so pertinent for the coming decades is that we have these four elements that are affecting how we deal with it. The travel dividend means that now it's possible, in theory, to be exposed to an infectious agent, to get on a plane, go halfway around the world, get off that plane before showing any symptoms. Whereas before, there would be a time to contain or to identify and enact containment exercises. Now, the incubation period is longer than the travel period. Population encroachment, and this we think is where a lot of hemorrhagic issues are popping up. Cities are getting bigger. Human settlements are getting larger. We're encroaching into previously unexplored or remote areas and exposing ourselves to previously remote diseases. And the primary healthcare gap in low-income countries. So if a potentially explosive pandemic infection arises in a country with very little primary care infrastructure, they're not going to be able to contain it, or maybe even identify it. And that's where the danger is. And so it represents opportunities for us to invest in surveillance, in public health strengthening programs, and other things like that. And that loops back to a detection bias. So maybe there's always has been a certain kind of infectious threat, but now we have surveillance systems that can detect it. So it could be that the threat is not higher, it's just more noticeable. Or vice versa. Maybe we don't have enough detection capacity to allow us to be alert to oncoming pandemics. That's something, actually, that's a powerful career investment, to be a disease surveillance specialist. All right, moving on. I mentioned that the environment, I believe, will dictate the professional quality of the rest of your lives. And I don't think one can understate the impact of climate change on everything. We're kind of, you know, insulated from it here due to our wealth and our infrastructure, but it's having really profound effects. The most obvious ways, most immediate ways it's affecting the world is through water quality and agriculture. I mentioned in the opening talk today that the people are saying now that maybe we should make way for agriculture and energy to dictate what the world needs. I'm leaning towards thinking the same way. Without food, you got nothing. Without energy, you don't have food. So those two industries will dominate the discourse the next few decades. And we have benefited of late, the last few decades, from certain technological leaps in agriculture. So there was a time where famine was around the corner. Somehow we have all this cheap food all of a sudden. Maybe you're in your 20s, maybe in your lives, you've never actually been in an environment where food wasn't comparatively cheap. But there was a transition that happened in the 70s or so where food in the West got really inexpensive, having to do with both political and economic issues and also with technological advancements in agriculture. But those dividends that came from that technological advancement have pretty much been exhausted. And the next technological advancement will be genetically modified foods. And people aren't that keen on that for a lot of reasons. So now with agricultural production being impinged upon via population expansion, because the more we're spreading out, the less farmland there is. and also by climate change. So now the robustness of certain crops to changes in temperature and rainfall is being limited, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia, where it may be in for a crisis. I can talk about this forever, so I better move on before I stop. But water quality is a big one. We're going to start noticing water quality issues very soon. Maybe not in this country, but we're hearing more and more about it in other countries. India is crazy. Okay, India. I can talk forever about India. So India's got water shortages all the time. And yet, if you go to New Delhi and you drive north, these beautiful, brand new 21st century highways, and either side, there are these enormous, empty new cities that are being built. And my first thought is, how are they feeding these cities with water? Where is this water coming from? And every few miles, there's a massive water tank. And then there are private highways. And then in the middle of the night, you see these trucks coming by, and they're spraying the highways. They're cleaning the highways with fresh water. Oh my God, where is this water coming from? I don't know. So there's a management issues happening where the disparity between rich and poor in these localized areas is creating an even stronger resource distribution issue. Okay, I'll stop there. All right. Next problem, or next opportunity, or next growth area is in information technology. So there's something called the digital divide. The digital divide is a different kind of disparity. We're probably used to the disparity between rich people and poor people, between well-fed people and less well-fed people, between well-educated people and less well-educated people. There's also a divide between people who have access to the greatest information resource in history and people who don't have access to the greatest information resource in history. Of course, I'm talking about the internet. And so people are studying this right now. And sure enough, you know, the trend is upward, that, you know, the more people getting access to it, but the speeds at which we're getting access, or wealthy nations are getting access to high quality broadband, are much greater than poor countries are. Even so, poor countries do have some access. One of my greatest revelations once was sitting in the Congo jungle blogging on my phone in the jungle. This was great. Oh my God. For like really cheap data access too, cheaper than here. It's amazing. However, in a lot of places, it's not the broadband isn't wide enough to allow important innovations in evidence-based medicine. So evidence-based medicine, as we all know, is the idea of using published information to make appropriate medical choices, also to make any kind of evidence-based decision through policy, whatever it might be. It requires access to good quality information. More than ever before, access to good quality information is gated by access to the internet or computers in general. I gave a talk about this in a country in South America a couple of years ago about evidence-based medicine, and a bunch of wealthy doctors in the audience. They said, yeah, we'd love to do this, but we don't have access to the journals. We don't have access to the CDs that the journals are on. We don't have access to the internet to access the journals. So they base their decision-making, their clinical decision-making, on their personal experience, which could be problematic. So there is an opportunity to assist in the growth of information technology in some of the lesser wired worlds. And there are programs out there right now that are really trying to jumpstart that process. Cloud computing has really changed the game a lot, right? So everything on my phone is on the cloud. If I lose my phone, I'm not too upset. I will be upset because I like my phone, but I haven't lost all my data anymore. Nothing is centralized. When I was a student, I remember paying, you know, thousands of dollars for a couple of minutes access to the Cray supercomputer at U of T. It was held in a cryogenic containment camp, and the guy with the white lab coat was watching me. Your time's almost up. Finish your, I'm almost done, right? Now, for pennies, I can have access to the Amazon.com supercomputer on the cloud. So that has really changed the game, in that now poor countries can have access to high-quality computing if the cloud access is made available for purposes of disease surveillance, doing their own large-scale epidemiological investigations. You're no longer dependent upon wealthy countries or wealthy partners to do that for you. All right, so and the last bit here is surveillance. So disease surveillance, I've repeated several times, is a really key concept that empowers nations to make decisions about their population health. And a lot of countries haven't got the infrastructure, expertise, or funding to do proper surveillance. Going back to climate change for a second, one of the recommendations put forth by the International Climate Change Committee is, or panel on climate change, is that we should set up a special fund for poorer countries to access money in order to do baseline analysis of their climate needs. Because without that baseline analysis, we don't know how to address their particular needs. So baseline data is missing in a lot of poor jurisdictions. Surveillance is part of addressing that gap. And this is part of the future of helping the world. Okay. The reduced role of doctors. Sorry, medical students, but the experts are saying that your role is going to be diminished in the future for a few reasons. One reason is that there aren't enough of you in primary care, and the second reason is the ones of you that do exist are too expensive, right? So the access to information technology will, one hopes, allow this transition to take place. Now suddenly we don't need a doctor on site to make decisions. The doctor can be elsewhere and via some information technology capacity can access a patient in different ways, but also allows training of lesser trained health professionals. Nurse practitioners, physician assistants, a degree of self. I've got the barefoot nurse is a novel. It's kind of cool. Self-care, something called MedExes. So my work in Guyana involves a kind of medical extender who is neither a nurse nor a doctor. It's a local who's been given extraordinary training, and they stay in their village and they treat their compatriots. It's a derivation of the Chinese innovation of the barefoot doctor from the last century. And so people are predicting this to become increasingly a bigger part of healthcare systems around the world. And in terms of career paths, I wouldn't recommend this as a career path for people here, but training regimens, curriculum development, partnerships, these are the kinds of opportunities that exist here. Yes?
Yeah, to that point, I was going to ask who trains MedExes.
Well, it depends on the country, but it's the governments who are responsible for it. But very often, they're partnering with NGOs or foreign donors to develop training programs, especially around specific issues like palliative care or HIV treatment or end-of-life care, it might be. Okay. So increased role of the private sector. We've been saying this for a long time, and it's unclear how that will look. People have been using the term public-private partnerships for a long time, and I never had a good example of that, except for one where Lever Brothers partnered with Harvard Public School to develop free soap that they gave away to places to reduce diarrhea instances. So Lever Brothers got the advertising dividend out of giving away free soap, and the people got the soap, and Harvard got the data, so everyone wins. But more and more, because the funding of NGOs is failing, pretty much every NGO I know of, their budgets are getting smaller. Their executive directors are taking pay cuts. It's not a good place to invest your career right now. They're looking for different ways to develop services, and those ways tend to be for-profit. So if there's a way you can develop a product that does good but makes profit, that's ideal. Information technology is the obvious path. You can make a health information system that is for profit that, as it's dispersed over entire nation, actually is quite ethical and reduces overall damage. So short-term mega investments in prevention, these includes huge vaccine initiatives. Right now we're seeing the malaria vaccine being rolled out, HIV vaccine and things like that. That's going to be pretty hot for the next couple of decades still. Investments in using nutrition as a prevention strategy, lifestyle, maybe even genetically modified foods. The experts are kind of unclear what they mean by that, but that's what they're saying. My specialty is in medical tourism, and this shows no signs of slowing down. And by the way, we wrote a book last year on medical tourism that is free to download. If you want it, just go to my website and follow the links. It's there. But increasingly, different jurisdictions are specializing in certain kinds of care and are drawing in foreign dollars to give that care. It's ethically problematic. For example, if you're a poor country that has spent money training its doctors, now suddenly the doctors are giving service to foreigners, you're not getting a return on your investment from the doctors you've trained. So there are policy solutions to that, such as requiring every time a foreigner comes for care that some of that money trickles down, whatever it might be. In Canada now, we are actually offering medical tourism services. There are hospitals in Toronto that are openly saying that they have specialized beds just for foreigners now. And they openly say it's a way to cover costs because they can charge foreigners more money than the locals. What I specialize in is something called reproductive tourism. That's when you go abroad seeking reproduction services. That can be sperm, eggs, it can be surrogate mothers, it can be any kinds of services. So this has no signs of slowing down. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and this will be the norm very fast. Empowered by, again, the sharing of information quite easily. If you even think about it, subtle things like sending your x-ray to India to be read by a cheap radiologist there is a kind of medical tourism. Kinda, maybe. That's also part of the future, is the decentralization of services. NCDs, the rise of NCDs. NCD is a non-communicable disease, right? So for the longest time now, people have been predicting that's the future. I don't know if that's the case anymore. We're seeing new spikes in infectious pandemics, but the experts are saying that we have to look out for this more and more. Name some of the big NCDs for me globally. Diabetes is obviously one. What's another one? There's one that I'm always curious to see if the audience gets. Shout it out. Really? Can't think of one? Okay, cystic fibrosis. I think that's a low prevalence one on a global scale. Metabolic syndrome, sure. Obesity, that's a good one. It's tied to diabetes. What else? Hypertension, absolutely. What else? Kidney disease, absolutely. There's one no one ever gets. Big one. Dementia is a big one, yeah. Okay, COPD is actually one of the big ones. Absolutely. There's one I really want you to say. Yeah. Cancer is a huge one, but that's not what I'm thinking of. Stroke is a big one. That's not what I'm thinking of. Somebody. So you're also medically oriented. What's going to kill you? If you take a trip abroad, what's going to kill you? Accidents. Crossing the street is probably the biggest NCD in the world. I'm being a little bit facetious, but not really, because these are things you can target from a public health perspective. Investing in a streetlight is a public health investment. That'll probably save a lot of lives. As a project I always wanted to do, to look at a jurisdiction like Trinidad. I like Trinidad because it's self-contained and the data's there, where we look at all the public health money we spent on something like HIV. And I choose HIV just to piss off people because, oh my God, you talk about HIV, right? And if you take that money instead and spend it on traffic control, how many lives would you have saved? I don't know. I'm kind of curious to try it out. I don't know how yet. Work on it. Anyway, so NCDs are expected to be a big deal. Now, the caveat here is when someone says something's expected to be a big deal, it doesn't mean someone's going to fund it. Right? So that's the distinction here. And that brings me to mental health. Everyone's saying that mental health now is the great new frontier in global health. No one's funding it. So if you want to direct your career in this direction, that's great. You will help a lot of people, but you're going to struggle to find funding, at least in the immediate term. And some of the issues around mental health is that DALY is a disability-adjusted life year. It was an indicator developed in the last couple of decades that allowed us to measure the impact of an illness or a poor health thing that doesn't kill you. Right? That was the revolution of the DALY. And so it looked at how disabled a thing makes a population. And when this was invented, oh my goodness, mental health concerns rocketed to the top of the list. Suddenly, being a bit mental health impaired was a bigger impact on a population's health than anything else. So the problem there is how you define poor mental health. This is culturally based. No two sets of physicians in different countries are going to agree. Right, so there's some problems there. The surveillance systems do not exist. So in a lot of low-income countries, we have no idea what the prevalence or burden of mental illness is. Here, we have no idea. I used to work for the Center of Excellence for Child Youth Mental Health here. We tried to do a systematic review to measure the prevalence of mental health issues amongst young people in Ontario. It took us years. At the end of the day, couldn't do it. Just could not figure out a way to measure it. Yes? Yeah. There are these one-off projects, absolutely. And the Grand Challenges has, a couple hundred thousand bucks here and there that are thrown at it. And it may increase. I hope it does. But it's not like malaria or TB or AIDS, which is in the billions, which is this is the nature of this issue, is literally of that scope. So the amount of money is in no way in proportion to the demand. So I got a couple slides left. We're almost there. All right. So international health law. This is a growth area where people are sort of looking at health at a global level as being a rights issue. I don't really understand it that well, so I can't talk a lot about it. I do know some of the elements that are popping up in conversation are things like pandemics as a security threat, right? And in fact, climate change is now being viewed as a security threat. So if there is ecological collapse in this country and it produces a lot of refugees, those refugees are now a threat to my economy, therefore it's a threat to my military security. The Pentagon has this groundbreaking paper that claims that climate change is the biggest threat to U.S. security of the next century. The Pentagon. It's crazy, huh? And in that paper, they actually spell out some of the health concerns that emanate from climate change that may be relevant to American security. Right. Which brings us to migration. So refugees are the obvious source of issues when it comes to migration and health, but mass migration of people rarely concerns refugees. I'm part of a mass migration. I come from Guyana, and everyone like me who's well-educated from that country left, right, for other reasons, separately, individually, as part of your family. It wasn't a big push. There wasn't a refugee camp. It just got on a plane and you left. That's a brain drain. So enormous numbers of people are moving around the world for a variety of reasons, and it's changing the ability of jurisdictions or local populations to give care and to predict the kind of care they can give. Climate change is a big part of that now. That's pushing the refugee process. There's this thing called urban refugees. That's where you're no longer in a camp. You're just, you know, you show up at the airport in large numbers and you're just dispersed in the city. So now research is going into the experience of people who are just essentially, they are still refugees, but they're living amongst us and just struggling, right? So again, there's no money here yet, but it's an issue. And so if you're looking for a place to invest your time and energies and resources, understanding that no one's going to fund you for a while, this is not a bad place to go. I like that image, though. Isn't that great? Migration. It's actually from a computer store migrating from Windows to Linux. It's migration. Agriculture. I got just two more slides, I think. Agriculture. I'm a big fan of agriculture as a good way to invest your career and as a good way to help the wherewithal of people around the world, because everything comes from food eventually, right? And we have a fascinating history with food, the human species, and the relationship between food and health going back 12,000 years. And the data is fascinating. For example, it turns out that when agriculture was invented 12,000 years ago or so, we lost a lot of health. So the hunter-gatherer modality was a very healthy way of living. When we stopped moving about and started living on grains, we lost a lot of health. It could be that we lost that health on average because people were living now that couldn't live before, including the weak. So on average, we're less healthy. But it wasn't until the 20th century or so that the human animal regained its height that it had 12,000 years ago due to advances in nutrition and things like that. Right. And we know this because of, you know, measuring the height of people who drew cave drawings in Europe and things like that. So the history of agriculture and its interface with human health is a gripping topic. That takes us to food security. So food security consists of three dimensions. The first is food availability. The second is food accessibility. And the last is food appropriateness. So the conversation is not just about producing enough food. It's making that food accessible. And then, is it the right kind of food? So it's a lot more complicated than it seems on the surface. Very and confounded by politics, by economics, by the stock market, which messed up food production in 2010 really weirdly, when all these speculators started getting involved in wheat futures, and the price of wheat was driven through the roof, and suddenly there are food riots in India. It was bizarre. Anyway, mixed into that is drug resistance. So how we are producing food is obviously having an influence on our relationship with pharmaceuticals if they are being involved in our food production, whether it's beef or cattle or pesticides or things like that. So how many slides? One, yeah, three slides left. So good. So I'll go through really fast. So governance, this is attempts to, just a way to organize ourselves better. And the recurring themes, here's the themes that come up. First of all, surveillance and information systems, that comes out a lot in all the data. Strengthening collaborations between players. Labor is a huge thing, so the roles of people in production. And strengthening public health, especially around surveillance issues, is kind of big. And climate change, that's the future. Last thing I'm going to say is the opportunities for global health work in the future. I think the three safe places to invest your career are in finance, weirdly, because everyone needs money. And this transition from vertical funding to horizontal funding is it requires expertise and some innovation. Information technology. It's amazing how much of my consulting business comes from information technology. People are making systems all the time, can't organize their data. The need is profound. And lastly, this idea of changing the structure of governance, whether it's at the NGO level or at the country level. These are areas where people are still in demand. 5 minutes of questions. Go. Yes.
I'm going to kind of draw on like your ability to talk for a while. A bit more about your kind of like knowledge around the mental health and the global health work kind of pairing. Because that's certainly my interest, but I've never seen it together, and it's certainly been something like a
It's the mental health arena when it comes to global health is still emerging, and there are very few places that specialize. Here in Canada, Dalhousie has a dedicated department of global mental health. Right, it's one of the only places that I know of offhand. And more funders are looking at small-scale projects. Like Ireland has this fascinating thing called Mood of the Nation. They use social media data to have a real-time prediction of probable depression in their country, looking at Twitter data, that kind of thing. So people are being innovative in using existing free big data for linkages purposes. I think that's going to be the future. The idea of using existing administrative and social media and other kinds of data in a creative fashion to do the surveillance systems that we cannot afford to create otherwise. Yes?
Do you think there's an emphasis on mental health because of an aging population?
Oh, that's a good question. No, I don't think that at all. Interesting nuance, though. I don't think it because the aging population is just in the West, and the mental health component that affects the aging population is mostly dementia, and that's not where the conversation seems to be around. Right? The dementia conversation is very much a Western conversation around homes and things like that. The overall grander mental health population is around schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression. Oh, wow, that's fascinating. So I got to repeat the question for the recording, sorry. The gentleman asked about the increase in naturopathic doctors as opposed to medical doctors. No. However, there is a lot of organizations have built-in policy that we're going to strengthen and increase reliance upon traditional methods. That's a lot of, in my experience, it's a lot of double talk because we don't really know what traditional methods are. And oftentimes, the traditional methods can be quackery. So in where I work in Guyana, sometimes the local shamans are kind of quackish, and they will use, for example, AIDS cocktail drugs in their traditional medication, give it to an AIDS, HIV patient. They start to get better. Then they start giving the stuff without the AIDS cocktail drugs. So, you know, so they're using the Western medicine as an entry into their stuff that often is not evidence-based. That's off on a tangent. I have not observed an increased reliance upon natural methods on a large-scale basis. In fact, what I observe is a greater demand for allopathic known Western medicine, like vaccines, like antibiotics. Yep.
Given that you emphasize the importance of agriculture and other likely medical students in the room, what do you see the role of physicians being, if any, in the development of agriculture towards increased health?
Wow, the role of physicians in agriculture. That's a really interesting question. I have no idea. I have no idea, except if you have an entrepreneurial spirit, there's an opportunity to maybe investigate the inclusion of medicinal component in food itself, right, through GM possibly. That's my first thought with 30 seconds, right? If I give it some more thought, I have some more solutions. But I think it may be wise for MDs to increase their training on understanding the sources of food and the ways that foods combine. And we need better evidence in nutritional sciences in general. I hate the Canada Food Guide. It's so agenda-driven, it's so politicized that it no longer has a lot of science underlining it. And yet we teach the Canada Food Guide to medical students still, and that's a problem. I think that's all the time we have. Okay, well, thank you very much.